Hello there, and welcome to Innovators in Care. I'm your host, Reuben Bush, and this is the show where we sit down with thought leaders in health and social care to talk about the problems they're solving and how they're innovating to reduce system-wide pressure and improve patient outcomes. In episode 4, we sat down with Mark McGlade and talked about looking at care as an investment, not a cost, and the work Mark and his team are doing to change perceptions of working in social care. Now today, we move into community healthcare. We're sitting down with Aidy Phillips, Specialist Falls Prevention Team Lead at Southern Health NHS Foundation Trust. Aidy is very passionate about falls prevention and is working on a number of exciting initiatives. In this episode, we dive into starting the falls prevention journey much sooner and working collaboratively with patients and families for the best outcomes. Enjoy. So, hello Aidy, welcome to Innovators in Care.
Thank you, Reuben.
I think it'd be really good, Aidy, if we started off with you could tell us about who you are, your background, and sort of your role historically and how you got to what you're doing now.
My name's Aidy Phillips. By background, I'm a nurse. I've actually been nursing 35 years in total this year, which is quite scary. Where's that time gone? I started on the inpatient wards working on a stroke unit, moved across to a haematology ward, and then when my children was quite young, worked on an older person's unit. As they began to get a little bit bigger, I needed to work with hours that fitted around school shifts and everything. So I moved across to the day hospital in about 2000, got very much involved in rehabilitation and health promotion and prevention work. So I've worked in the community care teams, done some shifts in care homes, worked in the community, and then 10 years ago, started work in the falls prevention team in Southern Health.
That's good. Thanks, Aidy. Tell us a bit more about Southern Health, what Southern Health is and what you do there.
Southern Health is quite a large trust, community trust, working with people with mental health needs as well as physical health needs. It's split into 5 divisions, of which the falls team that I'm part of is based in the southwest, but we're actually a team that covers the whole trust.
Yeah.
So we work with people in our physical health wards, our older person's mental health wards. We've been spending some time recently in our adult mental health units as well, but we also work very closely with the community care teams and the urgent care response teams and frailty teams. So more of a resource for those teams than actually going out with them as such, but we might work alongside new starters in a preceptorship role, upskill them in how to complete a multifactorial falls assessment, discuss complex cases, get involved with troubleshooting and ideas for actually how somebody could be managed in the community, have those difficult conversations with family members about the fact that actually they've had quite a lot of input from the community care teams and actually they need to either accept the ideas and support that the community care teams are saying need to be put in place, or they need to consider alternative care arrangements or moving home. So it's that balance sometimes. If when you go into somebody who may be a repeat faller, is it actually safe for them to continue being where they are? And if it isn't, do actually they have the capacity to make that decision that that's what they want? Or is there actually family members need to be considering a best interest decision in making sure that they've got suitable care and provision in order to keep them safe? So it is difficult because you need to remember that that somebody's life. And what is it that they want? Where do they want to spend their time? And actually, can we sort it so that they can live well and safely at home?
Yes, and that's very interesting because I know, having been in similar situation with grandparents, it can be quite an emotional thing, can't it? The thought of possibly having to give up living at home or taking on extra care. But it's often very necessary. How do you get on, or how do you cope with and manage that emotional side and actually explaining things to the families and the people and working through it?
It's taking time. It's listening to the people and thinking, what are you telling me? What am I seeing? This is what I've got that, you know, documented in the care notes. I can see the number of falls that you're having. I can see the type of things that are triggering the falls, for example, the fear of falling. So actually then not drinking enough, not going to the bathroom because you're worried that you're going to fall, and actually because you're not drinking enough, you're then actually exacerbating the condition because you're ending up with a urinary tract infection, which is then causing urgency, causing falls, causing confusions, and resulting in maybe an ambulance call out or a hospital admission. And trying to work out whether or not that's something that they're able to put things in place, and that could be the use of using prompts on Alexa, that could be using telecare, that could be using working with the care agency to make sure that when they come in and visit them at home, that they're actually making sure that the person's got a drink, that they can go and access refreshments themselves, that they've actually gone to the bathroom, so they've seen them walk and move, so there's not a change in mobility. Or it could be using other resources, sort of like thinking, have they gone to the church groups? Have they gone to the local lunch clubs? Are they still going out shopping? And really sort of like thinking, what is your social routine? Are you seeing people? Are you meeting people? Who would keep an eye on you? And then thinking, are you going to be safe? And if you were on the floor, what would happen? Could you get help? So as a team, we have used the razor chairs to actually get people down on the floor and say, look, we've got the razor chair. If you can't get back up, it doesn't matter because we've got a method of getting you back up. But I want to look at your plan as to how you would cope. How long would you be on the floor before somebody knew that you were coming? Because you've said to me that you don't want a lifeline. Or maybe you don't carry with you a phone with you, so you can't get help. And actually, the next person to come in and see you isn't actually going to be coming and seeing you for 3 days. So it's taking the time to have those conversations, to also sort of like give the family time to digest as well. And yes, there's so many options out there with that people can look at, you know, like if you've only just started with the care package, can the care package be increased? Can you then look at maybe lunchtime visits? Can you look at, you know, the attendance of places? But everything does cost money. And so it's working out the right package at the right time and also taking in people's interests. And then if it's not right, being able to support them to say, people like the Princess Carers Trust can help with those decision making. In Hampshire, we've got Andover Mind, which are very supportive as well. We've got carer support groups in Hampshire. So it's really, I feel, for our community care teams, that they really know what local resources are in their local environment, so that actually, when they're needing to have those difficult conversations, they can actually get other local community services involved to help support.
That's good. And that's very much a collaborative approach rather than being prescriptive or going in and trying to sort of lay the law down. It's very much working with them to get a result that works for everyone, isn't it?
It is, because actually if you lay the law down, you're just going to get people digging in their heels. And I think if you were to lay the law down and me and say, oh, you've got to do this, then I would probably want to go in the other direction and just go, no, not doing that. Or it'd be that why? Why do I have to do that? Why is that the method that needs to fit? It's like, who are we looking after, and what's the best for that person at that time? But it's also the fact that, and it was brought home in our supervision this week, the trust is very supportive with our staff, in that they encourage us to do clinical supervision, where we actually talk about cases, talk about what we're seeing on the ground. And one of the patients that Hannah had seen had been somebody in a nursing home, and the lady didn't want to go and join in the activities in the lounge. She didn't want to join in like going down for the meals at that time. And she'd said to Hannah, I'm grieving for my old life, my life at home. I need to have time to come to terms with the fact that I'm now in the nursing home and this is my new life. And that's not something we always think about when we encourage people to move.
Indeed. That's certainly food for thought, isn't it? I think it'd be good, before we move on to sort of what we're working on now and in the future, I think it'd be good to just quickly dip back into the past and the big C word, COVID. What changed for you in COVID, and what would you say were your key learnings from that period?
COVID for us as a team opened up opportunities. Part of the team was redeployed. So I went and worked on the older person's mental health ward at Alton, which we had COVID patients in the ward. And Hannah and the team went and worked in the community care team, but we came back and worked one day a week within the falls team, just overseeing incidents and chatting to people on, at the time it was via Zoom calls. But what it did, it opened resources for us, in that there is the time to try new things. At that time, we developed a Zoom class for people who needed to do exercises, who'd probably have gone previously to do the NHS balance class. It gave us the opportunity to use Zoom and team meetings to actually have conversations with people on other units and wards, to be able to see them. It made a big push to actually having our falls assessments in our community hospitals on Rio, so actually we could be looking at the notes in real time, so that we could actually discuss and advise teams of what they were seeing, so we could have that conversation with them. We could have a trawl through some of the notes to have a look and see, had they actually done that assessment on the floor? Had they actually used the proper equipment to get them up off the floor? Was there any, was there any mention of any call bells or anything of that put in place? And it gave us also the time to actually have a look at some of the projects that had been in place, but also the opportunity for us to have a look at the NHS balance classes, because they were put on hold face to face. So it gave us a chance to kind of have a look at the numbers that the teams in the community were seeing across Hampshire, and have a look at how successful the classes were in terms of, were they actually making a difference to people? Because we actually only do the upskilling section of the FAME programme for falls prevention of 12 to 14 weeks, whereas actually the evidence for a falls prevention programme is based on exercising for at least 30 weeks, 50 hours, so that you get the prescription dose needed to make a change. And whether or not we were giving people that key message about the fact that the exercises we're giving you are for life. It should be lifelong exercising, because actually you need to be moving in order to keep well and keep strong. And one of the things that we noticed is, in the different areas, the demographics of the areas very much played into how well people did following the classes. So, for example, in Gosport, they had a very good NHS balance class run by really experienced instructors. People attending them really enjoyed the classes, but there was nowhere for them to continue the classes in the community. So there was a gap there. There was nobody to join on to. In the New Forest, again, the classes were well intended, but there was an issue for a lot of the people attending those classes with transport because they were 10 to 15 years older than maybe the people in Gosport or Alton. So for them, unless they had transport, they couldn't then get to another class to continue them and carry on. New Forest isn't very good on, unless you've got a car, you don't necessarily have a very good structure with catching a bus or a train or whatever to then go to a class. Whereas in Alton, the NHS balance class actually took place in the leisure centre where the follow-on class was run. So the class which was run by the instructor was quite a high-functioning class run by an experienced physio who really pushed the people in the class. And actually, because they were attending a place that was familiar with them, they got to know the leisure centre staff, and there was about a 60% take-up of people going from the NHS class into the community class. So we're looking currently at the moment of where we're running our NHS balance classes. We're focusing much more on working with our the leisure industry within Hampshire, with the support of Hampshire County Council as part of our Better Balance Network. We're working with steady and strong instructors as well who run classes in the village halls to see if we can actually make sure there's a really good network of classes across Hampshire that people can go and then exercise long term. And another part of that, which is where I probably first really met the razor chair, is actually we were looking at what people were teaching in those classes and whether or not we were actually doing that backward chaining. Were we getting people down on the floor and what was stopping people? And actually, the fear of having somebody on the floor and not being able to get them up did make people very cautious and very safe. So actually demonstrating the razor chair or even the mangaralk or a different way of this is how we're going to get you up from the floor if you get stuck does mean that people are more willing to try. They're more willing to then think, oh no, actually this is fine, I can do the lunges. I know if I work on the lunges I'm going to build up strength in my legs. If I work on my sit to stands, that's going to build up the quad strength. I should give it towards sort of like, you know, 8-9 weeks of attending the classes, I might be ready then to get down on the floor and have a go at some floor work.
And that makes a big difference, doesn't it, improving the outcomes, doesn't it?
It does. It does. It's that mix of messages. It's that how we're going to keep you safe, the fact that we know what we're doing, but also the message that you need to be doing this or you need to be doing exercise for life, and hopefully we're going to progress you on to doing something that you enjoy. Because if you enjoy the exercise, enjoy the moving, then actually you're going to stick with it. And if you're physically fit, then if you do catch a bug, you're going to manage to get better quicker from it.
Yes, okay, that's good. I think that brings us on quite nicely to sort of looking to now and to the future. What new projects are you working on at the moment?
As a trust, the South West Division are looking at the evolution of the virtual ward with the frailty team and the UCR teams and how that's working. So that's quite exciting. It's, you know, that hospital at home approach, that keeping patients where they want to be, but actually being able to care for them. As a team, with the falls prevention team, we're probably going back to basics. And when I say that, what we're doing is we're doing work with our community care teams in that we're going to visit each team, we're working with them on what makes a good multifactorial falls risk assessment, getting them to have a look at the resources in their community. Louise Minnes, one of the therapy leads within the Southwest, has come up with a novel database for their team, which people then update so that actually they've got a local list of services so that everybody knows the information rather than one person in the team knowing the information. So it's really back on how do we communicate with each other, as well as to what resources are out there and what might support somebody, but also that looking at what makes what actually makes it a falls assessment, and then what do you do with the falls assessment once you've actually done the assessment, and where are the gaps in each area so that actually we can then let the commissioners know that actually I've got this patient, actually I think they need a helmet because they're repeatedly falling and hitting their head, but how do I get the helmet? Who funds it? Where, you know, that resources, and who do I go to for advice? So it's tying up all of those loose ends. We're also working with the Hampshire County Council with the community steady and strong instructors. So each month we're visiting a different steady and strong class. We're doing a talk with the people who are attending that class on what to do if they fall, making sure that that they're thinking about have they got a plan for getting up from the floor, giving them the opportunity that if backward chaining isn't part of their steady and strong class to actually have a go, because we're taking with us the razor chair. So we do a quick demo of that first. That's going down quite well with the classes that we've gone to. And it's one of the ladies, we heard from her the other day to say that actually she's been practicing when her family come round, getting down on the floor in different rooms. So she's got a plan in place. And another lady's actually got herself one of the Oyster pendant alarms so that when she's going out for a walk, she's got a way of actually contacting somebody that she's in trouble if she needs it. So
yes,
it's
okay.
People don't actually need the information probably on falls prevention until there's actually a problem. So this is kind of a way of just having those conversations as well. COVID actually also gave us the opportunity to put our falls friend talk online. So we have a monthly Zoom talk where actually people can join us for a session on falls prevention. And we've had family members who are in America, and I think it was New Zealand, actually joining those talks.
Okay.
So you had the person in Hampshire and the children in different countries actually come and join the Falls Friend Talk on Zoom. So that's quite a nice thing to be able to do. And we've very often find that we've got a whole nursing home that join in one day, or we've got a different team, maybe from the WRI, that have said, come and talk to us. So we're trying to sort of like really look at that early prevention work. What is it that we can all do?
Mm. Yes, and that's very good. And I remember the previous episode speaking to Mark McGlade from Home Instead. He was talking about often with care and the family and making decisions, they don't do anything or think anything about it until suddenly there's a crisis, and then decisions have to be made very quickly. So actually what we're saying is about encouraging to start thinking about it earlier so that there's things in place before there's a crisis, and actually getting a bit more support in earlier and doing the right things can mean that they can stay at home for longer, or that the person is actually healthier for longer. And that's exactly what you're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, that ageing well. That and living life well, not just existing.
Yes. Yep. That is very good. at the beginning of your answer there, you spoke about virtual wards. That sounds very interesting and exciting. Could you tell us a bit more about what they are and how you're working them?
There's money available from the government this year for a lot of CCGs, or the business units as they're now called, and looking at divisions and looking at how they actually work and what is it that people need. But actually having the virtual wards means that if you've got somebody at home, they've still got that access to that medical overview and might have antibiotics at home, they might have fluids at home, the bloods will be taken, somebody's looking at those bloods, they're making a medical decision as to whether or not they're safe to stay at home or whether or not they do need to come in for further investigations and treatment. But it also means, because you've got the therapy teams and the district nurses involved, that they're getting the right dressings, they're getting their insulin if they need it, they're having that home assessment for equipment and that support. So some of our patients who would previously have been had an ambulance call for a fall, they might have been picked up from the floor instead by our frailty team or our falls cars, and rather than conveyed from hospital, they're being treated at home.
Yes, okay. And there's obviously a benefit to the patient of living better, but there's also a system-wide and cost benefit there, isn't there?
There is a saving to keeping them at home. If you transfer an older person to hospital, the likelihood of them falling in hospital is quite high because they're unwell, but also because it's a new environment and they don't know their way around, so they're more confused. So actually, keeping them at home might be the safest place for them because there isn't that environmental confusion on top of being unwell.
Yes.
Which I think helps.
And, yes.
You've got your own pyjamas, your own duvet, your own things around. So actually, I think that's more comfortable for them. But they're having the right input. It's somebody's making sure that actually we're treating them correctly.
Mm. Yes, okay. I know you've mentioned before, we've talked about raises in the community, perhaps around community hubs or things like that. Be interesting if you could tell us a bit more about that.
So each of our community teams has a razor chair. So they go to each of our NHS balance classes so that you've got the provision there for if you need, you need it for demonstration, or if somebody needs to get up off the floor, you've got it there as well. But it also means that the teams can go out and pick somebody up who's on the floor. So that could be somebody who, when you've gone out to meet them, you've actually found them on the floor, and then it's that assessment, looking to see whether or not they're injured, thinking about how long they've been on the floor and whether or not there's a need to call for an ambulance, or whether or not they can actually use the razor chair to get them up from the floor. We're looking at the moment with regards to people who are over 23 stone or may have a body shape which makes them not quite the right shape to use a razor chair with. What do we do instead? What's the process? And at the moment, our process is that we would have to call the ambulance because they have different equipment. But it's looking as to whether or not that's what we should be doing. We're also having a look with patients who, the repeat fallers, whether or not we can actually issue lifting equipment for there, and thinking about where is it that they're actually getting stuck or falling. And for one patient who was actually getting stuck in the bath because they forgot that they couldn't use the bath, they kept using the bath, we've actually looked at the manga cushion rather than the razor chair because that suits that need instead. So it is matching up the right equipment to the right person. But it's also thinking about we've got somebody who might have a fall, such as the lady I met this week, and when she does fall, she hasn't actually got the physical strength to roll over, get on her knees and get up. But actually, because she has got support workers, they would be able to use equipment to get her up, but she doesn't meet the criteria of having equipment at home.
Okay.
So it's kind of like, where do we go there? Because in that situation, they have to call for an ambulance. And it might be that actually the ambulance would then redirect them to our community care teams because the person was non-injured, so they wouldn't need an ambulance. But it's for them, it's kind of like, well, actually, I could go and get a chair from somewhere, or somebody could bring it and we could then use it and then return it. So it's kind of looking, is there a way that actually we could do that model? Would it, you know, how could we make it work? And actually, we know for those support workers, they've had manual handling training, we know they've had first aid training. They'd be able to know if that person, because they know them really well, needed an ambulance or not, but they just couldn't physically get them up. So
yes.
Lots of work still to do.
Yes, okay. So that's a bit, almost like a bit like the defibrillator model, isn't it?
Yeah. I would like that. With the defibrillator model, though, you can't shock somebody if they don't need to be shocked. Whereas actually, with the razor chair, you could lift somebody with a fractured hip and cause more harm. So it's making sure that, you know, like you're helpful does help with that. And I think what I need is I need almost like a flow chart, so that it, as well in the hospital, because it's kind of like in our hospitals, we've got the hover jacks, but actually there was an incident the other day where somebody had a fall in the bathroom. And for the privacy and dignity of the patient, it would have been kinder to have used the razor chair rather than use the hover jack.
Yes.
Because we had to bring the patient out of the bathroom on the hover mat into the corridor and put screens around to then lift them up on the hover jack because of the space. But actually, the razor chair would have fitted in the bathroom.
Yes. Okay.
So there's work for us to do there as well.
Yes, okay. That's interesting. Thank you. So where do you think falls response work, and I suppose in particular falls prevention work, should be going in the next few years, Aidy?
I like the fact that you've split it into falls response and falls prevention. So from a falls response work, I think it's making sure that people know how to assess people for injury. I think they need to be able to identify the deteriorating patient, and I think they need to know where to get the right care and the right treatment for the person. And then they need to be able to feed them into the right rehabilitation to make sure that we reduce the number of falls that happen again. With regards to prevention work, I'd like it to start much earlier. I'd like it to start when you have your health and wellbeing check with the GP surgery at 50. I think that's a missed opportunity at the moment, where they may check, you know, your cholesterol and check your blood sugar, but actually I think they should be talking about, how are you aging? Are you eating well? Are you drinking well? Are you exercising and moving? What's your balance like? Because they could very easily do, you know, the outcome measures such as 5 sit to stands and see, have they got that quad strength? They could look at whether or not, how many steps it takes them to do a 180-degree turn, and whether or not they're overbalancing, whether or not they can actually stand on one leg for 45 seconds, and then look at ways of improving that strength and how they actually get their activity and move more.
Yes, okay, that's good. Prevention is always better than cure, isn't it?
It is. We're living longer, so we need to live better to enjoy it, not live a long time with ill health.
Yes, okay, that's good. And then moving that on a bit, So this is quite a big question. If you were in charge of community care at NHS England, what would be your key priorities? What would you change?
What would I change? I'd probably divide rehabilitation work from the routine community care work. Okay. I'd make it two separate streams, because if you've got a priority come in, something that's urgent, you're going to respond to that. So the routine rehabilitation work might then not get done. So actually, if we spent a little bit more time making sure that actually somebody was back on their feet properly following a fall or a hip fracture or coming out of hospital, then maybe they wouldn't need our services so quickly. I'd also look at the social care model, because very much at the moment, social care is very much focused on, are people eating and drinking, let's get your pad changed. And they're only maybe given 20 to 30 minutes to actually go in and do those visits. So they probably need a little bit longer, because if you've only got 20 to 30 minutes to do that care for somebody, rather than actually assist them to walk to the bathroom, you're probably going to take them the quickest way, which might be a wheelchair. So it's that I'd like to change, but I'd also like to include it in actually one of the visits that people have each day is actually a session where actually it's the focus is on exercise and movement. And it might be that if somebody is actually bed bound, then you actually work on passive exercises and stretches, so you reduce the risk of contractures and then getting pressure sores.
Yes. Okay. That's interesting. And you, when we spoke before, you mentioned about actually taking it right back and actually starting in schools.
Yes. I'd very much like it to start in schools. And that's thinking about our bone health as well. And the fact that when you're young, that's the time that you're growing your bone density. And so children need to be running, jumping, skipping, and having these movements where they're getting that impact to help stimulate the bone growth. They also need to be, you know, that vitamin D as well to help absorb the calcium to help make the bones stronger as well. But it's given children as well those sort of like messages about this is important, and actually all through your life you need to move. And it's not necessarily you have to go and do PE and do a 5 mile run or something. It may be that actually your thing is dance, and giving maybe in those year 10 and 11 the opportunity for students to actually try different sports and different dance classes or different ways of moving, which is actually going to become a hobby for life, which they then participate and maintain their strength and fitness.
Yes. Okay. Another thing you also spoke about was having, because we obviously there's dome care agencies at the moment that do personal care and the basic things, but you also spoke about having dome care agencies for like therapy and exercise, which I thought was a very interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah, and that comes back to my one of the visits being the focused on not just the social care, but that focus on the exercise. And when you actually meet people, I think sometimes people very much fall into the category where actually they will do everything for you. They're very nurturing, they're very caring, and it's much quicker if I do it for you. So you also need those people that are actually going to push you and make you do it a little bit more. And it's having, you know, having that time and having that focus. So is it actually that you train everybody up, or it needs to be a separate service in addition, or it, you know, this is what you need to come and do on this one? But there is a scope, because people will do the exercises very often when they've been to see a physiotherapist for the first 4 to 6 weeks, and then as soon as they're feeling better, they stop doing the exercises. whereas actually we need them to continue to do them. And very often just doing the exercises of on your own is boring. It's that motivation. What keeps you exercising? Some people love it. I teach a class on a Saturday morning, which means then that I continue to work on my strength and balance because I'm actually going to teach a class. So, you know, it's in my interest to teach it because then I do it myself. So for me, that's one of my motivations for keeping strong, but also the fact that I don't want to be in 20 years' time having somebody from the community care team come back and say to me, you said, make sure you drink plenty, make sure you eat your greens and your calcium, make sure you exercise.
Yes, indeed. Okay, that's been very insightful. And I think we've covered a lot of interesting ground there, Adi. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
No problem. Thank you for coming. Well, there you have it. We covered a lot of interesting topics in the interview, and I, for one, have a lot to go away and think about. I guess the two main points that stuck out to me were, number one, starting the falls prevention journey much sooner, rather than waiting until there is a crisis and urgent care is needed. Prevention is always better than cure when it comes to falls. Secondly, the importance of working collaboratively with patients and families to find the best solutions and outcomes, and then the myriad benefits this has for everyone that's involved. So, that's episode 5 of Innovators in Care. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time for episode 6. Thank you, and goodbye.